Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission today, well, it's pretty laser-focused. We're synthesizing a huge stack of sources for you.
A huge stack. We've got the latest Gallup polls, some really surprising local election results, high-stakes legal battles.
Exactly. And the goal is to give you the absolute fastest, most thorough understanding of where the political and economic landscape is right now.
And we're not just looking at the obvious headlines here.
No, not at all. We're trying to find those, hidden currents that are actually shaping the 2026 map.
And we absolutely have to start with those hidden currents. I mean, the hook today isn't just about the top line approval numbers, which are, frankly, quite challenging.
They're tough, yeah.
It's what's happening far, far away from Washington. We are seeing definitive evidence that these truly sleeper issues,
Things like electricity prices.
exactly, skyrocketing electricity prices,
Right.
often fueled by the massive energy demands from AI data centers. They are quietly swinging local elections in deep red areas. And that tells us that fundamental economic pain is, well, it's starting to crack partisan loyalty.
Okay, so let's start with that big political pulse check because these Gallup numbers, they really demand our attention. We're looking at an overall job approval of just 36%.
With disapproval spiking up to 60%.
60.
And that 36% figure is a major benchmark. Now, the all-time low was 34%, right after January 6, 2021.
Right.
But this 36%, this is a record low for what we sort of been calling Trump V2.0.
The political movement since he left office.
Exactly. He started that period at 48%. A sustained rating in the mid-30s, I mean, that puts the House of Representatives in serious jeopardy for the Republicans next year. And, maybe the Senate too.
And what's genuinely surprising here isn't the drop among Democrats. I mean, they couldn't really get any lower.
Yeah.
It's the erosion happening with independents. They fell from 33% approval down to just 25.
And even among Republicans.
Right. A slip from 91% down to 84.
That erosion among the base, that is the huge danger sign. That 7% dip in Republican loyalty, that's where the analysis really needs to focus.
Who are these people?
Who are these 7%ers? Well, they're likely voters who are feeling the pinch of inflation and those local economic stressors we mentioned, like utility bills.
So it's not ideological.
Not necessarily. They aren't suddenly anti-Trump, but they're asking, is the government doing anything to make my life cheaper? And when the answer is no, they pull back their approval.
Okay, so to put this in some historical context,
Yeah.
back in 2017, the average approval was 38%. That preceded the midterms where Democrats flipped 41 House seats.
A blue wave.
Is that level of devastation possible again, even with all the highly effective gerrymandering we have now?
That's the major caveat. You always have to mention it. Gerrymandering might reduce the number of potential flips,
But.
but there's a critical counterpoint to that. The dummy mander.
Dummy mander.
Yeah, that's when political models create these so-called safe seats based on flawed assumptions about how people will vote. Say, they assume loyalty from Black, Latino, or young voters based on old trends that are now shifting.
And if that model breaks.
If the model breaks, those safe red seats become highly vulnerable. A gerrymander can actually become a liability when a specific, unanticipated issue like utility rates just blows up the whole map.
So when we break down the administration's performance by issue, the results are, well, they're telling, the highest approval is on crime. It pulls in 43%.
Which fits the standard Republican platform, sure.
But then you see the political liabilities just stack up at the bottom of the chart. The lowest approval issues are, I mean, abysmal.
Yeah. Healthcare policy at 30%, the situation in Ukraine at 31, federal budget also at 31, the Middle East is barely better at 33.
Which raises a real question for me about polling accuracy. How can the general category of foreign affairs score 41% approval?
When all the specifics are in the toilet.
Exactly. When the two biggest international conflicts, Ukraine and the Middle East, are rated so poorly, what are people approving of?
It absolutely flags an ambiguity in voter knowledge. I think voters are giving a kind of general pass on the high-level concept of foreign affairs,
Yeah.
thinking about alliances or global standing.
While rejecting what they see on the news every night.
Precisely. They are actively rejecting the specific crisis-level conflicts. It suggests that if reporters focus specifically on how the administration is handling, say, key allies, that general 41% would just collapse instantly.
Okay, so shifting away from polling, let's look at the performance art coming out of Washington. The administration is heavily focused on executive actions, specifically this announcement to cancel all of Joe Biden's executive orders that they claim were signed by AutoPen.
A number they claim is as high as 92%.
92%.
This whole AutoPen battle is, well, it's classic political theater. It's completely performative in a legal sense.
Right, because an executive order is just a directive to the bureaucracy telling them how to interpret existing laws.
Exactly. And the simple fact is that whether the previous president signed it by hand or by a machine,
the next president can just issue a new one overriding it with the flick of a pen.
With the flick of a pen, it makes zero operational difference in the long run. In fact, if you go back to the George W. Bush administration, their own Office of Legal Counsel confirmed a president's authority to use AutoPens for these directives.
So the method of signing doesn't matter.
It doesn't invalidate the instruction. The only reason to highlight this is just to create noise.
Okay, but wait. They are making a special point about pardons. They're claiming AutoPen signed pardons are invalid. Isn't there at least some legal meat on that bone? I mean, a pardon is a more solemn constitutional act.
You'd think so, but not really. What's fascinating is a 1929 memo from the Solicitor General, which stated the Constitution doesn't actually specify how a pardon has to be granted.
So even an oral agreement would work?
Technically, yes.
Yeah.
Though, you know, written is obviously more practical. The administration's focus here, it isn't really the legality of the AutoPen. They're using the AutoPen to imply something deeper.
And that deeper implication is the real danger here, isn't it?
It is.
The suggestion that using an AutoPen implies a lack of mental competence. A lack of executive capacity.
That is the critical takeaway. Yeah. And it's a constitutional can of worms. Because if you successfully establish that a lack of mental competence can invalidate official acts without invoking the formal process of the 25th Amendment.
You've set a terrible precedent.
A terrible precedent.
Yeah.
A future Democratic president could then apply that same standard questioning competence retroactively against every act of the next administration.
Yeah.
It weaponizes the whole issue of mental fitness.
Speaking of political deflection, let's talk healthcare. Since the promises to lower costs weren't met, the strategy has clearly shifted to finding a scapegoat.
Blaming greedy insurance companies for rising health premiums.
Right.
This is the administration's way of avoiding the core financial conflict in modern healthcare reform. Let's just break down the mechanics simply for a second.
Okay.
If the government passes a mandate, meaning insurers have to accept seriously sick people without charging them extra for pre-existing conditions, that cost has to go somewhere.
Right. You stop the insurer from charging the high-risk person, so the cost burden just shifts.
Exactly. And normally, that shifting cost is absorbed by government subsidies that help pay those premiums. But since this administration opposes those subsidies on ideological grounds,
you're left with a bad equation.
You're left with mandate require coverage. Plus, no subsidy, government doesn't pay, which equals a premium hike. The cost gets shifted onto every healthy working person paying a premium. The only way insurance companies can stay in business is by jacking up premiums for everyone else.
So the political question really becomes, is the administration willing to admit that their own stance against subsidies is what's leading to the higher premiums they're now blaming on greed?
And that's a major opportunity for Democrats. They could clearly explain the function of subsidies here to diffuse that whole greedy insurer narrative. If a voter understands that high premiums are basically a tax on the healthy to make up for a lack of government funding, the blame game changes instantly.
Which brings us right into rising costs and economic stressors. We have a new villain in the household budget. It's replacing the price of eggs.
And that villain is electricity prices.
Absolutely.
Electricity is the new major price shock and is driven primarily by the astronomical energy demands of AI data centers. People are seeing this on their monthly bills, and it's quietly becoming a huge local political issue that DC just doesn't seem to recognize yet.
We saw proof of this in the recent Georgia Public Service Commission elections. I mean, these are races nobody outside of Georgia usually even watches.
No.
And Democrats won landslide victories in some extremely deep red counties there.
This is a huge bellwether. Voters in places like Hogansville, for instance, were furious about escalating utility bills. And a specific, localized $50 a month levy for a new nuclear power plant 200 miles away.
And they blamed Republicans for it.
Squarely. For being too cozy with the AI industry and utility providers. The two Democrats won on this single issue. In counties, Trump won by massive margins.
And this isn't isolated, right? The same issue came up in Virginia.
Repeatedly. The Virginia gubernatorial election, it kept surfacing. The public is demanding that tech companies pay the full cost of data center energy, not the ratepayers.
Especially since those data centers create almost no local jobs once construction is done.
Exactly. Voters are asking, why should I subsidize massive energy use for something that gives my community zero benefit? And politicians who can't answer that question are getting punished severely.
Okay, moving to consumer sentiment. The overall picture is low, but when you look at the graphs, there's a genuinely fascinating disconnect in who is actually optimistic about the economy.
Right. First, the partisan divide is still king. Republicans are much happier than Democrats.
Which is pure partisanship.
Pure partisanship. We know this opinion would flip instantly if a Democrat takes the presidency in 2029, no matter what the GDP is doing.
But the wealth divide, that's what's really striking. People who own stocks, about 60% of adults are feeling better.
But that 60% isn't uniform across the population, which creates a political problem. 70% of white adults own stocks versus 53% of black adults and only 38% of Latino adults.
And that disparity explains why some groups might feel disproportionately negative, even if the national numbers look stable.
Of course. The top third of income earners are more optimistic. Because if you have money left over to save or invest, even with high inflation, you're participating in the stock market's growth.
Mm.
For the 40% of Americans who don't own stocks, rising prices just mean a shrinking budget.
And then there's the most counterintuitive graph of all, the age surprise.
So fascinating.
Young adults under 35 are far more optimistic than older people, especially those 55 and up, even though younger adults generally have lower incomes and fewer assets.
Right. And while, you know, idealism is a factor, we have to look deeper. Older Americans are often on fixed incomes. They're deeply sensitive to inflation eroding their savings.
Mm-hmm.
Younger adults, though, they see themselves as still climbing the earning ladder. They might see current hardship as temporary, believing their future earnings will outweigh today's high prices. They're optimistic about their potential, whereas older voters are worried about preserving their present assets.
Okay, let's switch gears entirely to the legal and electoral battlefields that are shaping the immediate future. Starting with a definitive legal loss that really sends a message.
Yes, the three-judge panel decision unanimously upholding the order for that payment of, what was it, $937,989.39.
That's the one. Against Trump and his former lawyer, Alina Haba, for that bogus racketeering lawsuit against Hillary Clinton.
And the significance there is the panel's composition. The judges were appointed by George W. Bush, Joe Biden, and Trump himself.
When you get a unanimous ruling across that wide of a political spectrum,
it's not an ideological decision. It's a statement about the quality of the litigation. It sends a clear message that this type of politically motivated, baseless lawsuit will be punished with serious financial penalties.
And this fine just adds to the pressure stacking up against the $83 million E. Jean Carroll judgment that's on appeal.
It does.
Now, in foreign policy, we have this highly sensitive leaked phone call about Ukraine and Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff.
It's jaw-dropping.
The leak suggests he's coaching Russia on how to sell a peace plan.
Yeah, the leak suggests Witkoff is coaching a top Russian official, Yuri Yushchev, on how to structure a Ukraine peace plan so that it appeals to Trump. Witkoff, I mean, this is a guy who has idolized Trump for 40 years and has called Putin not a bad guy.
So he's freelancing foreign policy.
He appears to be completely freelancing and, you know, toting water for Russia.
This brings to mind that quote from the seasoned negotiator Aaron Miller. Deals are cut when there is urgency, meaning both pain and prospects for gain.
Precisely. And right now, Putin is clearly not experiencing enough pain to negotiate unless he gets to dictate the terms. Witkoff, who seems desperate to please his idol, is likely trying to structure a deal that Putin wants, then helping the Russians frame it so Trump sees it as a win.
Which would be a clear dictate outcome from Moscow.
And it completely undermines any serious U.S. negotiating position.
Okay, so let's turn to the immediate electoral bellwethers happening this December. These are the races that are testing all these underlying tensions we've been talking about.
Especially that economic pain threshold. We've got several runoffs highlighting the progressive versus moderate Democrat fight. In Atlanta, you have Mayor Dickens-backed moderates running against candidates supported by the DSA.
The Democratic Socialists of America.
Right, for city council and school board. You see a similar dynamic in Jersey City with former Governor Jim McGreevy running against a working families party-backed progressive. These results will show where the energy really is in the Democratic base.
Then you have races focused on immigration and ICE. In the Albuquerque mayoral runoff, the current Democrat mayor, who limited cooperation with ICE, is facing a pro-IC Republican former sheriff.
and a big win for either side there says a lot about local sentiment toward enforcement policy, you know, regardless of all the national rhetoric.
But the race that truly tests our core thesis, the anti-utility and AI backlash, is that Georgia HD 121 special election.
The absolute must-watch race.
This district is extremely red. Trump won it by 22 points in 2024. If the Democrat, Eric Gisler, flips that seat.
It validates everything. It proves that the anti-utility sentiment we saw in those PSC races was not a fluke. It means economic pain is flipping seats in rural areas, and it's a huge signal for 2026.
And finally, let's not forget the challenges popping up against established Democrats in New York City.
Right. Young progressives like Chiosa and Alexa Avalés are targeting powerful incumbents like Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries and Dan Goldman.
Goldman is a fascinating target. He was the lead impeachment counsel, he's a progressive himself, and he's very wealthy.
Which makes him incredibly difficult to knock off. The challengers have to move very, very far left to create any daylight between themselves and incumbents who are already, you know, card-carrying progressives. It makes for a really contentious primary.
So as we synthesize all this, what does it all mean? We've gone from a specific 36% approval hurdle and that performative legal noise about auto pins
to the surprising economic split between stock-owning and non-stock-owning demographics.
And most importantly, we've pinpointed these immediate electoral indicators in Georgia and the Southwest that are being driven by energy prices and local economic frustration.
The key insight, I think, is that even with widespread gerrymandering, economic pain, specifically localized, rising costs like electricity, can break through. It can overcome partisan loyalty. The results in Georgia are telling politicians that scapegoating, whether you directed it at insurers or previous presidents, it won't work if voters feel it in their pockets every single month.
So here's a final provocative thought for you to chew on that kind of builds on this theme of economic fairness. We noted that Swiss voters recently rejected a 50% inheritance tax, and the Washington Post ran an editorial congratulating them.
Right.
Now, we often hear debates about taxing earned income versus capital gains. But consider the simplest defense of an estate or inheritance tax, preventing people from becoming billionaires purely by lucking into the right parents.
It's a fundamental question of fairness. We accept taxing earned income, which is money someone actually labored for, but that feels, well, fundamentally different than taxing someone who acquires billions by birthright.
So if voters are looking for a tax that addresses fairness and prevents the creation of vast unearned wealth,
perhaps the focus shouldn't only be on income, but on inherited assets. It's an issue that will absolutely resurface for the 2028 debates.
Something to mull over as you watch those Georgia results come in. Thanks for joining us for the deep dive.
Always a pleasure.